It's a pleasure always to be out here in Centerville speaking to the Bull Run Roundtable, and particularly a wonderful experience to be here for the 150th anniversary commemoration of the battle. I was in the Park Service in 1961. Fortunately, since it was a very, very hot day, they're very lucky since it's a big reenactment day, they didn't get any people hurt bad, because they were all the reenactors were what are pejoratively considered FARBs today. It was very hot, and the people who were, fortunately, I was in Vicksburg, and they didn't bring me in to be a ranger that day, so I missed the big day. This time I will be the one of the main speakers there, following the Marine Band on the 23rd. So I have a good one welcoming in. Well, for as you're going to see on the first map we're going to use, it shows a general situation. Until there's both the Union and the Confederates will raise and organize men. The Confederates are brighter than the Union, because the Confederate Army initially is raised for 1 year of service. The Union folks that have answered Mr. Lincoln's call for 75,000 volunteers, for 75,000 militia to serve for 90 days. So if you can see, if Lincoln calls for these 90-day people, on the 15th day of November, 15th day of April, you're going to not, doesn't seem very smart to figure if they're reported for duty immediately when they're going to be out of the service. Lincoln, so the Confederates will form, beginning around the first day of June, an army on the plains of Manassas, with its headquarters in the Centerville area, commanded by an instant hero who a few months before was a major and had the shortest tenure of any superintendent of West Point, 4 days. And he, by the end, as we get into the 12th day of July, will have an army of about 26,000 men assembled in and around Manassas, the plains of Manassas, with one brigade thrown forward to Fairfax Courthouse. The other Confederate force in the area, since the first day, since the 15th day of May, has been commanded by Joseph Eggleston Johnston, who are assembled up in the lower Shenandoah Valley. By the time we get to the 12th day of July, which is going to be a critical day, Johnston's army has been forced to abandon the line of the Potomac, giving up Harper's Ferry, and his men, numbering some 11,000 men, have fallen back to Winchester. Now the Union forces are assembling in two armies. One will be the Army of the Potomac, commanded by Irwin McDowell. Irwin McDowell had been the assistant adjutant general in the United States Army, and he was picked by Salmon Portland Chase of Ohio for that important role. And of course, he had been a staff officer his life. Now, if you've been in the service, you know there's a distinct cleavage today between staff and line. Staff, line have little respect or use, and they generally refer to staff officers as pukes today. But it wasn't maybe as bad a word then. But that means that, Beauregard had also been always a staff officer. So McDowell will, by army, will be in and around Washington. And since the 24th day of May, they've held Alexandria and Arlington Heights. The army totals about 32,000 men. Now commanding an army which had advanced southward from Chambersburg is an army of 20,000 men, commanded by Robert Patterson, 69 years young, a colonel in the War of 1812, the second in command to General Scott on the army that marched from Veracruz to Mexico City. By this time, his troops occupy the Harper's Ferry and the lower Shenandoah Valley. Now, Lincoln, on his own initiative, the best way to save money now is like they did in the Civil War. Congress adjourned on the fourth day of March, and since there's no air conditioning, does not convene unless called into special session until the first Tuesday after the first Monday in December. They can be called into special session. Mr. Lincoln believes he can settle the crisis without calling Congress in session. In fact, he will take some things that would be, if the Union had lost, he would not have been thought very highly of. Without having any money, no funding, no authorization, he will expand the regular army, infantry regiments, from 10 to 19. A number of the people called out for 42,000 of those men called out for 90 days are going to have some ambitious governors when Lincoln calls for 42,000 men to serve for 3 years. How are you going to like it if you have a pissant for a governor? Governor Ramsey of Minnesota, who happens to be in Washington on the 2nd and 3rd of May, and decide that the first Minnesota really signed up for 3 years. And you're going to run see your lawyers. Now, they're going to be the first three-year regiment raised, and they will be at Manassas. And it isn't going to make any difference to those men that die. And all those battles are going to be in. Because the ones that live can boast, we're the first three-year regiment in the Army. But Lincoln now realizes he needs money. So he calls Congress into session. And they convene on the 4th of July, the nation's holiday. And they'll immediately approve all of Lincoln's actions, calling for the expanding the regular army, calling for the 43,000 of three-year men, the blockade proclamations. He'll do it, but they're going to be a big problem to General Scott, the general-in-chief, and the General McDowell, because they can figure these 90-day men are soon going to be getting out. We've got to get some use out of them. And they raise a cry on to Richmond. General Scott will side with General McDowell and will say, "Our men are green. They're not ready to march on Richmond." And Lincoln, the country lawyer, will say, "Yes, they're green, and you're green, and they are green too. So if you're both green, let's get on with it. Now we have a very talkative United States Senator from Massachusetts who likes women. That is Henry Wilson. And either in the privacy of her boudoir or salon, he is going to make a statement to Rose O'Neill Greenhow, who was then the hostess with the mostess long before Pearl Mesta became hostess with the mostess. And he's going to confide with her, "Sweetie, you know our army is going to march, have been ordered to march." Rose will give it to Betty Duvall, a more athletic and a better writer. And the Confederates are going to know within 24 hours that General McDowell is ordered to march. McDowell will set his timetable to begin the march west to attack the Confederates who have come up with a defense line along Bull Run with an advance brigade at Fairfax Courthouse. And E. Porter Alexander is going to turn it, the tables, on Dr. Meyer. He had worked for him on coming up with a signal system. And he's already set up his signal system that is going to be very important long before Meyer can do it. Our friend Porter Alexander has erected 6 signal towers. 1 here, 1 on Signal Hill, the key one. Overlooking the Stone Bridge, and 3 others. They has 20 intelligent privates and trained them in the use of signal flags. Also, you can see on that map, railroads had been known, but never in warfare had they been yet used for strategic purposes. And General Scott knows that the Manassas Gap Railroad runs from Mount Jackson up the Shenandoah, down the Shenandoah Valley to Strasburg, through Manassas Gap, and into Manassas Junction, where it converges with the Orange and Alexandria for going on into Alexandria. So General Scott realizes you've got that problem. General Patterson, and I'm looking at him over there, he reminds me a lot there of that man sitting with the lady, the nice-looking lady with glasses on, and to the right of the red-headed hat there. That is General Patterson's alter ego. General Patterson has given orders. Do not let General Johnston leave the Shenandoah Valley. Patterson will give a reply, and it's going to be this. Think if Adolf Hitler was his boss or Joseph Stalin. Would you send a message that if Jack Johnston leaves the valley, you may shoot me? So Scott feels pretty good about it. That's the best assurance you can have. He's given the general-in-chief, hopefully he'll be backed up by the commander-in-chief, permission to shoot him. So instead of pressing forward from Bunker Hill toward Winchester, he pulls back to Halltown. So needless to say, Johnston is going to leave the valley. Well, Beauregard has set up his defense plan. Bonham's brigade will not leave Barak's courthouse until the evening of the 17th. General McDowell's army will move out in four columns, all of them converging on Fairfax Courthouse. By the morning of the 17th, by the evening of the 17th, his lead division, now most of these Union commanders you will not hear again, because the North had a bad break. Many of the people that stayed loyal to the Union are men a little up in age. Now remember, there is no retirement in the United States Army for officers until the Congress that assembled on the fourth day of July will do it. And unless if you're in your 60s or in your 70s or like the Chief Surgeon of the United States Army, 80 years old, you are not going to resign from the Army unless you're personally wealthy or marry a rich widow. So that means that General Daniel Tyler will get his big chance, and his will be the first division to leave Fairfax Courthouse on the morning of the 18th. By noon on the 18th, he is in Centerville, on that highest point of ground in Centerville, where he has the road, the Warrenton Turnpike, 29, and he has 28 following the same alignment. General McDowell has arrived about the same time with his chief engineer, John Barnard. John Barnard is as deaf as a post. He's a pretty good engineer, but this is when you had to use trumpets in those days if you're seriously deaf. So while the other divisions are closing up, General Tyler gets orders to move down the road going to Manassas Junction, Highway 28 today. There are two crossings in the area. On what is Highway 28 is Blackburn's Ford, and the county road that crosses at Mitchell's Ford is in existence. So he is advancing. Now let us look at the Confederate positions as they take ground. Richard Stoddard Ewell, old Baldy, Baldhead, a family that has a habit through number of generations of marrying first cousins that will generally enhance if you have some strangeness in your family. So he will be watching the crossing down where the railroad crosses Union Mills. Coming up the stream, near Beauregard's headquarters at the McLean House, will be J.R. Jones, who has a bad ticker. He's going to die in February of 63. Not like he probably preferred to die on a battlefield, but die of a heart attack. His brigade is there. At Blackburn's Ford, this man's eyes are lighting up. Just covering Blackburn's Ford is James Longstreet. As they pull back, like all people do when they're retreating rapidly, Bottom's men cross at Mitchell's Ford and take position there. Upstream, watching several crossings, such as the Ball's Ferry Ford, the ford just south of the Stone Bridge would be the richest soldier in the South, Philip St. George Cook. Spells his name Cock, but pronounced it Cook. He is going to be dead of a heart attack, of suicide, before December is over. He has a small, has a brigade, and watching the Stone Bridge is the smallest brigade, commanded by the Gentle Tiger, 6'4", 270 pounds, rubber of wheat, consisting of two units, the ones that all reenactors like to be, the Louisiana Special Battalion. They're Zouaves, but they're not ritzy fellows. They're Zouaves. Their britches are made of mattress ticking that you get in cheap mattresses, a gray with a blue stripe, and some of them wear straw hats. The riffraff from the wharfs of New Orleans. And with him, of course, is the 4th South Carolina. In reserve is a brigade commanded by Lee's bad old man, Jubal Anderson Early, who has two common law wives, never marries, one black and one white. People like scandal about these people. Unfortunate, so as Tyler and Martyr get overly encouraged, they think the Confederates are doing a precipitate retreat because those South Carolinians and the 11th North Carolina attached to that brigade are throwing away gear. So Tyler decides to exceed his orders and will tell Fighting Dick Richardson, a West Pointer. Fighting Dick has a very swarthy complexion, and he has two names to the enlisted men, Fighting Dick and Dirty Dick. And he's a very aggressive customer. And he's going to deploy forward toward Mitchell's Ford, the first Minnesota, the first Massachusetts, and his two Michigan regiments, the 2nd and 3rd. He's going to send the regiment, the 12th New York. They're going to be supported by the fire of Ayers' battery. Ayers are going to say, I fired the first shots in the Confederate Army there, because he considers Blackburn's Ford a part of the Battle of Manassas. Lieutenant Haynes considers the 21st is the first battle in which you will fire the first shot. And they get overly bold as they go forward, and the men of the Washington Artillery open fire. Longstreet's men and Bonham's men have thrown up earthworks. Kemper's battery at Mitchell's Ford is dueling with Henry Hunt. Boy, the Confederates wish they had a Henry Hunt in their army to be their chief of artillery later, but unfortunately for Bobby Lee, his chief of artillery may be a good Episcopal minister, but he's a hell of a chief of artillery, William Nelson Pendleton. And it's not fun when you get shot and you see men coming to the rear. And the 12th of New York ain't very happy because they're going to be repulsed. And coming up in support of them is a 2nd Brigade in Tyler's division, commanded by none other than William Tecumseh Sherman, who has no use for volunteers. news. And as men begin to see these frightened New Yorkers coming up out of those woods leading down to Blackburn's Ford with their eyes looking like Lee Harvey Oswald as Jack Ruby fires that bullet into them. So that takes a lot of the fight out of General Sherman, and McDowell is not happy. Therefore, the reconnaissance has boomeranged. The Confederates have drawn first blood. So McDowell is going to waste 2 days while he and Barnard reconnoiter the Confederate position and come up with their plan, which will go into execution at 2 a.m. on Sunday the 21st. Meanwhile, in Washington, they know there's going to be a big battle. The beautiful people, as I call them now, using a modern name, but that's who's coming out. Joe Hooker will be out there out of a job observing the battle, as will be Black Jack Logan and a number of others. There'll be a number of congressmen, and your president, looks like Congressman Ely from upstate New York. He's out there, but he's going to find out when he has to go back to Washington fast, someone has stolen his horse, and he's going to be the only one that is going to see Richmond. And better yet, you're going to get a trip to Charleston, South Carolina, and spend some time in Castle Pinckney. But you're glad to get there when Colonel Cash wants to murder you in cold blood later that day, because you're one of those damn abolitionist congressmen. But the Confederates have stolen a march. As Robert Patterson reports, Johnston is in the valley. Angus MacDonald, with his cavalryman, is sewn a good screen. And the first people in the valley, General Johnston traveling with the CD professor, Tom Fool Jackson. He is not yet the mighty Stonewall. And his brigade is not Stonewall. They spend the night of the 18th of Paris. Not France, but that one in the shadow of Ashby Gap. And on to Piedmont Station, now Delaplaine. The right orders are not too cooperative, and they have to take strong action, because most of them, since they're mechanics and skilled people, have loyalty to the North. But by evening of the 19th, Jackson has arrived, and General Johnston, although he ranks Beauregard, says, "I will defer to you. You're familiar with the terrain. You know the men." On the next day, on the 20th, will arrive two more brigades. The brigade commanded by Bernard B., and the brigade commanded by Colonel Bartow. Now, I wish we had a spiritualist, because we want to know what B. really meant. Does he mean what the South Carolinians will swear he does, or will he mean what the Virginians swear he does when he says, "There stands Jackson like a stone wall"? But we can never consult with him, because when he's wounded, he never recovers consciousness and dies without revealing that. So who's a spiritualist here? And we'll send them to confer with B and find out what he really meant. The last brigade will not arrive till 3 o'clock on the afternoon of Sunday the 21st. That's the brigade commanded by E. Kirby Smith. They're delayed by a train wreck. So both people have got their heads together. Now Johnston, it's Beauregard's plan. He said the Union, we'll go over the Union plan first. We're going to use two divisions to turn the enemy's left. we're going to cross Bull Run up above Sudley Church. Move down across Catharpin Creek by Sudley Church and turn the Confederates' flank. The Confederates have no cavalry watching the left flank. The two divisions charged to do that will be the division commanded by that northern general that all Southerners love, Black Dave Hunter. A pyro in the minds of many of my Southern friends, a pyromaniac. One of the few officers in the United States Army who is an abolitionist. He dyes his hair and he dries his hair and beard black. But they say when they call him black, it's not because of the color of his hair, it's his soul. So he will have his division. All Southerners will go say here in this audience, why in the hell didn't they hit him hard when they hit him on the morning of the 21st and just put him out of action for a short time? And he will, in his division, he will have his lead brigade is commanded by Ambrose E. Burnside, a man who is like Joe Bleek, the man with that cloud of gloom hanging over him that used to appear in Little Abner. Whether it's in romance or commanding troops, he doesn't do very well, or selling a successful weapon to the United States Army. The other one will be Andrew Porter, a man who will soon disappear because of age. Following them will be the division commanded by Sam Heintzelman, a former major, and he has three brigades. Two of them will be involved in the morning's fighting. That's the brigade commanded by William Franklin, who will prove you may be first at West Point in your class of 43. This is your classmate of Grant's, but you will go from first to last. And he'll be followed by the division commanded by Orlando Wilcox, a West Point brigade. Staying at where the road they're going to march on, that road that goes through that country club area on the west, on the east side of Bull Run, and to the east and to the west of Cub Run, that'll bring them into their turning position. And off they go. Having the lead, however, is General Tyler's brigade. And they're going to go towards Stone Bridge and faint. Rough an attack there. Keep Evans pinned down. He'll have the brigades commanded by Fighting Bob Schenck. His political name, not his fighting name. But he's a man that wrote the book on stud poker. So if you had to go to Las Vegas, of course, they don't play much stud. They like to exercise their thumbs and fingers now, pressing buttons. So they can't claim they're for help there. He will have his brigade. There will be William D. Sherman's brigade. And there will be Erasmus D. Keyes's brigade. Keyes had been military secretary to General Scott, and already had 50 years in the Army, if you want to start calculating his age. His other brigade is going to be sent with Davies' brigade down to keep the Confederates honest by demonstrating in front of Blackburn's Ford, McLean's Ford, and Union Mills Ford. And off they go. Their marching is slow, and by 6:30, Tyler's advance has topped where the beautiful people will soon be arriving and to watch the battle on the watershed. And Peter B. Haynes will put his 20-pounder parrot in, and boom, and he's going to say, "I fired the first shot at the battle of Bull Run, and the shot will light near Portici, where he sees some Confederate officers lolling around. The column is moving around, and we'll pick them up at about 9:30. Meanwhile, back to Beauregard and Johnston. Now, Beauregard's plan, fortunately, he's going to start it at 7:30. That means the Union have committed themselves before the Confederates begin moving. Now, if they'd gone at the same time, they'd been little like little black Sambo, I'm being politically incorrect, going around that circle. Because the Confederates are going to turn the Union left with their right. Thus, Richard Stoddard Ewell started off, crossing Union Mills. You'll be followed by McLean, you'll be followed by Jones crossing at McLean, and last but not least, by Longstreet crossing at Blackburn. But you're going to be lucky. Before you really cross, you're going to have to change your plan. But that means that since they crossed to your right, that means that Ewell and Jones is going to say, "What the hell? We crossed, and we've got to go back across again. And we're going to wait around till late afternoon, and then we're going to cross again. And we're probably wondering what's wrong with our senior officers." What has happened is technology is again being used by the Confederates, not to concentrate, because take 10,000 and 26,000, and you now have Johnston and Beauregard have 36,000, and the enemy have 32,000. Look at that man over there. He's very proud of himself, because he's not going to get shot. He's just going to resign. All right. So, as he's up in a signal tower on Signal Hill, looking through his binoculars, Alexander sees the woods. Sees an open field, and he sees coming out into that open field cannon. The sun reflects, and then he can see troops. So, for the first time in military history, he'll send two messages. One is to the signal station at Pennsylvania, and it is to Evans, "Look out for your left, you're being turned." The other will go to the signal station near Union Mills, to Johnston and Beauregard, indicating that there's a strong Union force moving to turn the Confederate left. So, the Union have the initiative. Meanwhile, Fighting Bob has come up in front of Union, in front of the Stone Bridge, sends the 1st and 2nd Ohio down to the ford leading toward Portici, Lewis Ford, commanded by one of the Fighting Bob McCook, Fighting McCooks, the 14 Fighting McCooks, Alexander McDee. And he'll be skirmishing with the Confederates on the other side of Lewis. The 2nd New York will be skirmishing with the Confederates on the other side of Bull Run at Stone Bridge. At about 9:30, the vanguard have reached Sunday Church. There's been too much hauling to pick berries, too many filling their canteens out of both Bull Run and Catharpin Run. And Hunter takes up the march, riding south on Sunday Road, followed by Burnside's brigade. Meanwhile, Evans has taken action. Evans has told Rob Wheat, I want you to take your special battalion, leave four companies of the 4th South Carolina to watch Stone Bridge, and get your tail up on to Buck Hill, that first low slope as you leave, turn north and pass by the stone house and engage those enemy. As the vanguard gets to the crest of Matthews Hill, almost the first shot dings General Hunter. Hurts him, but it puts him out of action, but doesn't kill him. So he cannot practice his pyromaniacisms in the Shenandoah Valley. Even if you're related to him, it doesn't help you with your property. This guy loves him. I can see him. You and Bob Crick have one thing in common. You both love David Hunter. All right. So Andrew Porter is now in command. And Burnside deploys his men east of the Sudley Road, puts 8 cannons into position. The Union have lots of James rifles. Why then does the Union only have 4 James rifles at Gettysburg when they could have all James rifles? They aren't worth a damn. He's taken a good smoothbore gun, converted it into a rifle gun, and has made a very poor bastard gun. And he has, the guys I feel the sorriest for, 2 Dahlgren boat howitzers. These are made for landing parties, and they're pulled by their crew. They're not pulled by horses. And he deploys his men. The women will all love Burnside's brigade, because in the second Rhode Island is Solomon Ballou. And I can always see when you watched Ken Burns' The Civil War, when he uses Solomon Ballou's letter to his wife, which he writes the day before he dies. Well, Evans and his men have delayed the enemy. And about 10:30, who arrives on Henry Hill, overlooking Young's Branch? 2 Confederate brigades. The brigade commanded by Bernard B. And the brigade commanded by Colonel Francis Bartow. And they move in to support the Union forces, to support Evans's brigade. Already Robert O'Heed has been shot through the lung. He's going to live. Recovering down in the Alcee Ames Beauregard, down at the Brandy Station battlefield, to die the next time, to die on June 27th at Gaines Mill, when his men will give their name to Taylor's brigade, the Louisiana Tigers. And Porter would have deployed his brigade. Now he's a division commander in support of Burnside. His men are going to be mixed in with Burnside's people. But they bring with them, Porter brings with him the West Point Battery, the senior unit in the United States Army. They have been stationed at West Point when all the Union units in the United States Army had been disbanded before the Republic, before the Constitution. Company D, 5th U.S., commanded by Charles Griffin, who during the war will prove that he doesn't suffer fools gladly, whether it's General Grant or General Meade. They will soon be joined by Heintzelman's people, Franklin going to the support, with his battery, which is Ricketts Battery, I First U.S., at the Dogan House, dueling with the Confederate guns on Henry Hill for guns. When Wilcox arrives about 11 o'clock, his brigade goes to the support of the Union troops fighting on Matthews Hill, east of Sunday Road. Sherman is now crossing. He's crossing at the farm ford. Earlier in the day, Sherman had seen a big burly fellow. It has to be Robert L. Wheat before he had moved over to Matthews Hill, ride down and cross the ford. Sherman had noted it. So about 11 o'clock, Sherman will go to Tyler and say, "Can I take my brigade?" And will wade Bull Run at Farm Ford. That means he can't take any artillery with him, because the ford is not passable for wagons, and he'll be followed across there by Erasmus E. Keyes. Now, as we get toward 11:30, the Confederates have been very aggressive. In fact, the regiment you don't want to be in of all Confederate regiments on the field is the 8th Georgia. Two companies from Rome, Georgia, so they call them the Romans. And they have held four Union brigades pretty much at bay. The news that Sherman is arriving, followed by another brigade coming in on the flank of Bartow, this forces B to decide to abandon the fight. What have they done, though? They have delayed the Union from about 10 o'clock till noon. As they fall back, abandoning the fight on Matthews Hill, crossing Young's Branch, going by the Stone House, and withdrawing up onto Henry Hill. Now, McDowell is not very charismatic. Now, if he'd been like Jackson and been a good soldier, maybe they would have thought he wore like what we call a pith helmet now. Jackson, of course, wears that kepi from VMI that he pulled low over his eyes. But to the soldiers, since McDowell is going to lose, this does not give him any charisma. He also has a gargantuan appetite. They can remember him sitting down and eating a big watermelon with his staff, not sharing any of the watermelon with them. Could be eating lemons and he could be colorful. And then pronounces it monstrously fine. Slightly overweight. And now he's ecstatic. As we get to the noon hour, he thinks he's won the battle. He's riding about riding by the Stone House, up east and west along the Warren and Pike, up onto Matthews Hill toward the Dogan House, shouting, "Victory, victory, victory!" Meanwhile, there's been the activity with Beauregard and Johnson. About the time they decide to order B and Bartow from the reserve position near Blackburn's Ford, and they move off and have been gone about an hour, Johnson decides to reclaim command. Remember, he ranks Beauregard, but he'd yielded the command to Beauregard. And Johnson will say, as he can hear the firing coming down from the north, from Matthews Hill, he says, "The sound of the guns, I ride to the sound of the guns." And he starts for Henry Hill. Beauregard realizes, if I'm going to be the commander of the army, I better go too. So he and his staff follow Johnston northward as they travel up on a country road that will lead them by Portici. As they move out, they tell Thomas Jonathan Jackson to start moving his brigade northward from a position where they're in reserve to the west of Blackburn's Ford and Mitchell's Ford, and come to the support of the Confederates that are battling on Matthews Hill. Jackson will arrive about 1 o'clock, going by Portici. Now, everybody seems to forget that Jackson is never in command on Henry Hill. Because when they get to Henry Hill, Johnson will have a meeting. Johnson says, I will go back to Portici, and I will send the reserves forward from Portici. So Beauregard, the forgotten man in most descriptions, is in command on Henry Hill. And if he didn't like where Jackson formed his men, he would have sure told him about it. So Jackson, when he arrives on Henry Hill, the wood line is just about the same as it is. Jackson did not form his men where that statue is. If he had formed his men at that statue, where that statue is, Jackson would have been as dead as the deadest man on the battlefield. They wanted it there because that's the most prominent position on Henry Hill. So where he is sitting, his horse, is back beyond, behind the gun line. His men are going to form in the edge of the woods from on the far right, the 5th Virginia. On the far left, the 33rd Virginia, and goes 4th Virginia, 5th Virginia, 4th Virginia, 2nd Virginia, 27th Virginia, and the 33rd Virginia. They're in support of 13 guns drawn from a section by the gallant Pelham. I don't want any of you ladies to have a picture of Pelham like Peggy Volksberger does in her wallet. The Rockbridge Artillery, commanded by William Nelson Pendleton, with their guns Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Units from the Washington Artillery. Now, the Federals now, as they're beginning to top Henry Hill, coming up from the Young's Branch, they will be the men of B, Bartow, Evans, and Wheat's people. They've done a good job. Now, at this time, according to some the staffers of B, he will say, and they say he doesn't say it in a, he says it in a pejorative way. B will say, there stands Jackson like a stone wall, undoubtedly remembering when he had come up onto Henry Hill, he had advanced to the support of B, to the support of Evans and Wheat. So seeing the Confederates reforming, now taking position on the right, meanwhile, the Confederates have abandoned the four companies that were on the west side of Stone Bridge have been withdrawn. And Fighting Bob is now in possession of Stone Bridge. And he begins to push forward with a great deal of caution, showing that maybe if he wrote a book on playing draw poker, he would urge a cautious approach, because he's going to make no contribution the rest of the day. Now, seeing this situation as it's come, General McDowell will meet with Major Berry, his chief of artillery. And he'll tell General Berry, I want you to advance two batteries up onto Henry Hill and establish a gun line. And the batteries will have infantry support. So the two batteries that are going to move up and take position on Henry Hill, within less than 400 yards of the Confederate gun line. The Confederate guns are all smoothbore. Ricketts' battery is all rifle guns. And that you do not want to match six rifle guns against at a less than 400 yard range against 13 smoothbores. Because the smoothbore projectiles, they're within canister range, you're within shrapnel range, and a rifle gun can fire canister and shrapnel, but it's not its best casualty producing agent. So on the other side of the Widow Henry's house, they position Griffin's five guns. Griffin has snapped a pole. I'm not a farmer. If you're a farmer, they snapped a pole on one of the limbers when they crossed Young's Branch. So he has his five guns into position, and the Confederates are getting the better of them. Jackson's men are either sitting or lying down in the edge of the timber. You cannot see them. The only thing you can see is the rebel artillery. Now the Widow Henry, being in her mid-70s, has asked her sister and her daughter and her slave, take me down to the spring. I can't stand this noise. When the guns come up there, it's worse. So she has herself carried back in the bedroom. Unfortunately, some Confederate sharpshooters are in the barn, in the garret of the house, and they open fire at a 50-yard range on the left section of Ricketts' battery, and begin inflicting casualties. So Rickett says, has the two guns on his left section, wheel to the left, boom, boom, boom. The house is set afire. Mrs. Henry, 75 years old, can't stand to have a foot torn off, and she'll be dead before morning. The Union troops are coming up very slowly, the infantry. Sherman, when he comes up, will feed his men piecemeal in. He will not throw all four of his brigade, his four regiments in. He'll send them individually. The 69th New York, the 79th Pennsylvania, the 2nd Wisconsin, and the 13th New York. So he does not build up any base support. And meanwhile, Berry has now noticed the Confederate artillery position. And he decides, I'm going to have Griffin move his two 12-pounder howitzers from his extreme left. He would be moving them right through the visitor center now. They should not have put the visitor center there. They should have put it between, he passes them between the visitor center and the Sunday Road. And he's putting in position so he can enfilade the Confederate battery line. As they're there discussing things, they can see some men in the woods in front of them, 65 yards away. There's a fence there now. It's not in very good shape. The Park Service should replace it for the 150th. And they notice these men coming over the fence. They're wearing a bluish-gray uniform. This is the 33rd Virginia, commanded by Colonel Cumming. As they cross the fence, they begin to take position. And they begin moving the 60 short yards toward the two guns. And there's a big argument between, maybe this is why Captain Griffin later in the war doesn't suffer fools gladly, whether it's General Meade or General Grant. He's going to say, those are the enemy. Barry says, no, there are support coming up. So as they argue whether they're friends or their enemy, they're now closing rapidly. What has happened to their friend, their support? Jeb Stuart with the Black Horse charges the 11th New York Fire Zouaves. And the New York Fire Zouaves take to their heels. Too late, Barry says, I'm wrong. Griffin cannot swing his guns half wheel to the right before the enemy have fired on them. Their horses are down. There's a charge, and they've captured the two guns. Jackson Singh has ordered a charge by his entire line. 27th Virginia, 4th Virginia, 2nd Virginia, 5th Virginia, and the 7th Virginia, commanded by Colonel Hutton, Eppa Hutton. They belong to Cook's brigade. They're going to charge. And they're going to capture the other 9 guns. Griffin is wounded. And he faints. Sherman is going to order in one of his regiments. They're going to order in the 1st Minnesota. They're going to charge. And the Confederates are going to be driven from the guns. Griffin recovers his consciousness, and he says, we've got our guns back. But arriving now is the 6th North Carolina. They belong to B's brigade, but they had to come all the way from Orange. They have arrived. So this time the charge is going to be spearheaded by the 6th North Carolina. Beauregard is out there leading a flag, running around, leading charges. I just want to understand that everybody forgets who is in command on Henry Hill. And this time they're going to recapture the guns. They never recapture. The two guns of Griffin's always stay in the Confederate hands. I'm talking about the other 9 guns. So when Riggs recovers, the enemy has the guns, and there'll be a last charge as we get toward 4 o'clock, spearheaded by the 49th Virginia, commanded by Extra Billy Smith. B and Bartow have their men reorganized, and the Confederates are going to capture the guns. They've now changed hands 5 times, and they will not change hands again. Unfortunately, we don't know when B said, rally on the Virginians. Remember, he says, there stands the stone wall. All Virginians will swear, he says it as one continuous phrase. There stands Jackson like a stone wall right on the Virginians. B's staff, who would be prejudiced naturally, say he said it at 2 different times. And he says the final one shortly before he's killed, mortally wounded, never to recover consciousness. The man there with that good mustache looks like he'd make a good spiritualist. And we'll find out for us. So the battle has been decided. Now, meanwhile, Oliver Otis Howard has finally arrived. He has taken possession on Chin Ridge. Coming all the way from Winchester is Kirby Smith. Before he gets in action, he gets wounded. So Arnold Elzey takes over his command. There he's going to be joined by Stuart and Lee's bad old man on Chin Ridge. So Ewell will have the 7th Virginia, the 7th North Carolina, and the 13th Mississippi. And with Elzey's three regiments, 1st Maryland, 10th Virginia, and 2nd Tennessee, they will take care of Oliver Otis Howard. And by 4:30, the Confederates are victorious. The Union are retreating. They'll all retreat the way they cross Bull Run. So that means if you cross at Sudley Ford, you'll go back by Sudley Ford, which means you've got a long way back to the Warrenton Turnpike and to cross Cub Run. If you're Sherman and Keyes, you'll go back across the Farm Ford. If you're fighting Bob, you'll go back the way you came. The Confederates will pursue. The beautiful people are getting out of there as fast as they can. They can see little about the battle, except see which way the smoke was going. Congressman Ely, someone has stolen your horse. And you're left there. The Confederates will pursue. And arriving up there where the beautiful people had been, on the watershed between Bull Run and Cub Run, is Kemper's Alexandria Artillery. They've been joined by that old troublemaker, Edmund Ruffin, agricultural reformer, and they'll let him fire the first shot. And the first shot will cause two wagons crossing Bull Run to lock wheels, and what had been a retreat turns into a panic-stricken rout in which the Union had taken from the morning of the 16th to noon on the 18th to get out to Centerville or back on Arlington Heights on the morning of the 22nd. That shows you can run much faster than you can go. Now, you're going to have a narrow escape, Congressman Ely, because you've fallen into the hands of the 8th South Carolina, commanded by Colonel Cash, a noted duelist who has fought and bested 8 men in duels. And he finds you a congressman, finds you a Republican, and he wants to blow you into kingdom come. Fortunately for you momentarily, the sergeant major thinks it might be a big problem murdering a congressman. So you will stay behind the sergeant major, who stays between you and Ely. You'll be glad when Porter Alexander shows up, a West Pointer, and will reason with Cash. You don't want to murder that guy. He's going to be worth a lot for us on swapping prisoners. Well, only one Confederate wants to pursue the Yankees. That is, needless to say, Thomas Jonathan Jackson. But both Johnston and Beauregard say our men are almost as badly demoralized by our victory as the enemy are by their defeat. Jackson thinks he has a chance because at 7:30 that morning, Jefferson Finis Davis, Notice I'm one of the few that uses his middle name because he didn't like it very well. And not only his mother thought that because he's the last of 10 children. So he boards a special train. Through train all the way to Gordonsville. There a transfer to the Orange in Alexandria. And he arrives about 6 o'clock in Manassas Junction. Gets on a horse, coming by a small staff, arrives on Henry Hill. Jackson will go to him, bypassing the chain of command, and urge him to overrule Johnston and Beauregard and order a pursuit. Davis, when he writes his memoirs, will not be particularly courageous, because he had the power to overrule, as commander-in-chief, Johnston and Beauregard. But of course, when the Confederates go up the spout, he can just think of what it might have been if he had showed executive courage and had overruled them and had ordered a pursuit. We don't know what would have happened, but it couldn't have been any worse for Davis than it ends up being. So we have the first battle in the war, and the Northerners will strengthen their resolve. Lincoln will proceed to call for 300,000 men to serve for 3 years. The Confederates will be encouraged by their victory. They believe now what their politicians such as Robert Toombs had told them, that one Confederate could lick 10 Yankees with a broomstick. It's going to be reinforced with what happens at Wilson's Creek on the 10th day of August, when the Confederates again beat the Yankees in a battle that involves about 20,000 men. So the Confederates gives them a false sense of security. It gives the Union a determination. And you can just imagine the president. On the 16th day of May, a telegram had come in to the Secretary of War. Now, General McClellan knows how to use telegraph. Following the Battle of Rich Mountain on the 13th of July and the Battle of Corinth Ford on the 12th day of July, he sends a telegram to Washington, a copy of a telegram to Washington on his address to the troops, which would do Napoleon proud. It shows that McClellan, unlike Grant, who had read about great captains. The library records for when Grant are at West Point indicate, yes, John, you have a chance to be a great general, because Grant checked out romance novels. Not books on great captains at West Point. He will, paraphrasing it, he will say, "Fellow soldiers, you have annihilated 3 enemy armies, led by trained and experienced soldiers who have fortified mountain fastnesses at their leisure." Can you imagine Lincoln reading that? There's somebody we need. And on the 22nd, the day after, McClellan will get a telegram to come to Washington, and very soon he will be named commander of what he will designate the Army of the Potomac. Thank you for your listening. Sharing my thoughts about the Battle of Bull Run. Now, when I was a child in Montana, I was very democratic. I named the heifers, I named them after battles. So that meant when I had a heifer that grew into a cow named Antietam and had a calf, I could be all-encompassing. The calf became Sharpsburg. Thus, the heifer that I named Manassas, when it had a bull which got castrated, I named it Bull Run. And I did not change his name to Steer Run when he got castrated. So I've always had an interest in these events. And they're, I wanted to focus on the novel things, like my colleague from Air and Space said, on the balloon, because that's another thing that is going to be like the signaling by mirrors and flags, like using the railroads for shuttling, using them for strategic purposes, as besides using modern technology and showing that the Battle of Bull Run. If you ask people about it, what's unique, they'll talk about the beautiful people, because the beautiful people will not come out again. They've seen their one battle. And the congressman, what happened to Ely, aren't going to be one to see on the battlefield. Any questions?
What was the casualty rate?
All right, the casualty rate. The Confederates lose about 2,100 men, and the Union a little over 4,000. The big difference is in prisoners. It's not a bloody battle. For instance, when you fight the Battle of Shiloh, that'll be the great denouement. You can take the casualties in all the battles in the Civil War before Shiloh. You can take the battle casualties, I'm not saying sickness or disease, in the Mexican War. The battle casualties that die from trauma in the War of 1812, and the battle casualties that die from trauma in the Revolutionary War, you'll have more casualties at the Battle of Shiloh. As they say, after Shiloh, the South will never shine, never smile again. Yeah, Senator.
Why did McDowell use Theodore Runyon's brigade? Just because they're from New Jersey, it was prejudiced.
What?
Why did he use Theodore Runyon's brigade or division?
Well, he does not use all his men. Neither do the Confederates use all theirs. He doesn't use He uses what he thinks are his best divisions. He doesn't use Dixon Miles' division, which is probably well, because Fighting Dick Richardson will have charges brought against Dixon Miles for being intoxicated on the field of battle. He will be found drinking at the advice of his doctors, and Dixon Miles should have been probably cashiered, but he'll be around at Harper's Ferry on the 15th and 16th, the 15th day of, and 16th day of March, of September 1860, two to make the Union probably wish they'd cashiered him. They also have Stahl's brigade of ethics that is not used. It consists of three regiments of German speaking, and the best regiment of all, my favorite in the Civil War, the 39th New York, the Garibaldi guards that would have to speak Esperanto to command them, since they have you have companies made of about eight different ethnic groups.
Yes. Did Patterson ever get shot, or did he ever get a clue as to what's going on?
Well, I would think if I was General Patterson and made the errors he did, and was serving in the Wehrmacht or the Red Army, they would have shot him. Because he gave them permission to do it. He gave the United States permission.
But did he ever catch on to what Johnson had done?
No, he doesn't catch on till the 23rd. And the 23rd, he resigns. He catches on 36 hours later.
Why did General Cook commit suicide?
What's that?
Why did General Cook commit suicide?
General Cook, suicide.
He was well-to-do, and I think he, because of the war, his age, and he owned, and it's really strange. There are two or three of the most magnificent plantation homes in Virginia he owned. So he had everything to live for, you would think. They're located at Palmyra. They're magnificent, the three of them. They're all three in different ownerships now.
Sir, what was the relationship between Beauregard and Johnson following this battle?
All right, Beauregard and Johnson's relationships now, at the end of the Battle of Bull Run, and for about 2 months, it's very good. As they don't follow up, as McClellan builds this powerful army, Davis gets upset because they didn't follow up. They're going to have what you would have when you have a bitter family divorce. They're going to come to a position where Beauregard wants a transfer. So in January 1862, Beauregard will be transferred with only his staff, but with no soldiers, to the Department Number 2, which is the department commanded by General Albert Sidney Johnston. So he goes out to join Johnston with his staff, but no significant reinforcements. The Union, of course, are reporting him coming west with at least 8,000 or 9,000 men. So I think Johnston would have been better off with 10,000 men than with Beauregard, because Johnston, as you go up to Shiloh, Johnston defers to Beauregard. Johnston makes only one decision, major decision, in the days leading up to Shiloh. That occurs on the evening of the 5th. On the evening of the 5th, the Confederates have deployed within a mile of the Union camps. Beauregard believes in his mind that the Union know they're coming and have been entrenched up to their eyebrows. And he wants, supported by General Bragg, he wants to curtail the attack to take place the next morning and go back to Corinth. Johnston then makes his one decision, and we don't know what the final result would be, but the final decision is that I would fight them if there were a million. So Johnston has opted for the battle after letting Beauregard do the deployment and call the shots up until that moment. So we don't know what, if the Confederates had fallen back and had not brought on a battle, the Confederates would have evacuated Corinth, just like Beauregard is going to do 2 months later.
Sir,
as you referred to the people that came out from Washington as the beautiful people, is there any record of beautiful people from the South coming to picnic in the battle?
No, there's no great, there might be some of the locals coming, but they're not coming. It's too far to come from Richmond up there to see the battle. Too far to come up from Culpeper. Yes, I'm sure there are people from Manassas Junction, but Manassas Junction isn't very big. So this, but to the North has caught the enthusiasm. They think it's going to be a big battle. They're time to see it. So the beautiful people will come out. And now you have to like Joe Hooker's nerve. He's out on the battlefield. He can't get a job because he's on Scott's S list. And he's going to see the president the next day. You go see the president easy in those simpler days. And he goes for a meeting with the president the next day. On the 22nd, he says, "Mr. President, I don't know how good a general I am, but I'll tell you one thing, I'm better than any you had out there yesterday." So the president writes a note for him to go see Secretary of War Cameron, and within 24 hours, Hooker is a brigadier general.
What happens to McDowell?
McDowell will become a corps commander under General McClellan. First under General Pope, and then under General McClellan. After the court-martial, after the battle of Second Manassas, McDowell will testify against Fitz John Porter. And his testimony will be very important in getting Fitz John Porter cashiered, which will be reversed 13 years after. So I just wonder if he'd been promised command of the Department of the Pacific. Because that's something that could not be put in writing. But he's soon commander of the Department of the Pacific, which is out at the Presidio in California, where he spends the rest of the war, which is a good place to not get into serious problems. Okay, I'll take one more. And then
one more question.
Thank you for your lecture. How much did McDowell really understand the topography of the land south of Bull Run?
Can you hear him? Can you hear him?
No.
Oh. How much did he understand the topography?
How much did he understand the topography of McDowell?
McDowell had been, he had 2 days to come up with his plan. I'm sure he's reconnoitering with his chief engineer, Barnard, and because McDowell had always been a paper shuffler in the old army. So he's probably, as an eye from the course he took from his professor at West Point, Dennis Hart Mahan. But he had not commanded troops in the field. So I doubt it that he would have the eye of an engineer as Beauregard and Johnston would or Lee would have. And so and the maps are not good. The maps that they're using do not have contour lines. And as you know, if you've been out there, he knows where the fords are, but I doubt if he knows how high the various elevations are. I doubt if he knows the elevations. I don't think he knows about the unfinished railroad grade. I don't think he knew where the boundaries of the woods and fields. So he would be at a disadvantage, and so would Barnard, because Barnard would be seeing it from a distance, but he, in theory, would be seeing it from an engineer's eye. Barnard's actually, most of his engineering duty, he had been building forts. So he'd be more of a construction engineer than a field engineer.
Thank you very much.